Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, August 18th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. Last week my guest on the LaRouche Show was Helga Zepp LaRouche, and we focused on the now visible evidence that the global financial system has already crashed, precisely as Lyndon LaRouche had forecast. Helga spoke of the contradictory statements and actions of leading Wall Street and City of London players, who one day were saying, let it fall, we need a shakeout, let the hedge funds take their lumps, and then within 48 hours were desperately demanding that the central banks pump in hundreds of billions of dollars to avoid a chain reaction collapse of the largest banks and investment houses. This week, we saw more of the same. More cash was pumped in to cover bad debts. Panic and chaos were everywhere. On Friday morning, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke lowered the Federal Reserve discount rate by half a point after having said for quite a while that he was not going to do it. In fact, after being praised by the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times editorially that morning for not lowering the discount rate. But he did so to temporarily halt the meltdown of the stock market. We also saw an old-fashioned run on the bank, Countrywide Bank, out here in Southern California, which is the bank of the largest home loan company in the nation, Countrywide Financial Corp. Countrywide was bailed out by 40 banks this week for $11.5 billion. And then when the dust cleared, we were told that all is well. Everything is fine. The stock market went up on Friday. Therefore, we can go to the beaches for the weekend and live in the dream world that everything's as it should be. Despite the fact that the underlying cause of these perturbations is the ongoing collapse of the physical economy as a result of more than three decades of post-industrial policy, which has been imposed on behalf of the leading cartels of a reconstituted Anglo-Dutch empire. With us today on the LaRouche Show to discuss these developments is my guest, Paul Gallagher, who's one of the directors of the economics desk of the Executive Intelligence Review. Later in the program, we will be joined by our panel of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Today, the LIM panelists will be Michelle Lerner from Washington, D.C., and Jacob Johnson from Seattle, Washington. So, Paul, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thanks, Harley. Good to be on.
With all these developments of the last days, the tremendous volatility in global stock markets, currencies crashing, a wall of money strategy, assurances that all is well, tell us, where do things really stand now as of 3 p.m. Eastern time today with the world economy?
Well, at the top, You have the central banks of most of the major nations, particularly the European Central Bank, the Federal Reserve here, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of Korea. These banks, as of Friday, clearly had reached the stage of panic. You can see by the fact that one of the governors of the Federal Reserve, William Poole, the St. Louis governor, speaking in Chicago on Thursday, said that the Federal Reserve would only cut interest rates in the case of a calamity and that they were not about to do so. Then they did so the following morning. You can see the degree of the panic which has reached these central banks from the major commercial and investment banks, which are banging on their door demanding liquidity in order to get through another day of this crisis of margin calls and lack of ability to sell, roll over, or redeem securities all throughout the credit markets of the world. Another instance that gives you an idea of this, where the panic, the force behind this panic is that on Friday, at the same time as the Federal Reserve, as everyone knows, lowered its discount rate suddenly and out of the blue by 0.5%, it also injected an additional $6 billion into the banking system. It did so, 98% of this was buying mortgage-backed securities, from these banks, these same radioactive mortgage-backed securities, which have triggered this crisis.
And Paul, when they inject money like that, and they say it's 24 hours, 48 hours, 1 week loans, so they buy bad paper, do the banks then have to buy it back at the end of the term?
There is a term, and at the end of the term, the transaction is supposed to be reversed with a little interest paid to the Federal Reserve for
that. How does that solve anything?
Well, it generally doesn't happen in that these loans are then generally, these very short-term loans are then generally rolled over. They can be rolled over many times. In addition, the Federal Reserve in addition to the other things it did, also announced a change in policy on the direct loans to banks through the discount window, and that is that these loans would now be for a minimum of 30 days and would be could be rolled over indefinitely at the request of the borrower, that is the bank. So they are moving to make these injections essentially permanent injections, although they appear to be very short-term. The demand for banks for this injection of capital on Friday was $72 billion. That is, banks wanted $72 billion worth of injections from the Fed and made those $72 billion worth of need known. The Fed injected only $6 billion. It gives you an idea that the European Central Bank has been going crazy and injecting hundreds of billions of euro into the banking systems more than once across Europe. The crisis is equally bad there, and the bank has simply been overwhelmed by the dry up of liquidity within the banking system. So what we've seen here now, that's the situation at the top. If you look down then to the bottom, you have a report that just came out from Fannie Mae, the big government-sponsored mortgage lender in the United States, saying that its chief economists think that the median price of homes in the United States is set to fall another 6% during 2007 and 2008. Such a fall, it's not only unprecedented. The 2% drop that's already taken place hasn't happened since the Depression. A fall of that magnitude in the median price of every home in the United States would be immense, and it gives an idea of the on-the-ground misery that is still to come, the delinquencies and defaults and loss of homes and the loss of money in people's homes that is still to come in this crisis and is driving it to the demise of the hedge funds and the commercial paper funds and so forth.
In a sense, Paul, when you have a drop in prices of that sort, it actually becomes an incentive for someone to default on a loan because what they're paying, their mortgage, is now larger than what they could get back if they sold the house. And so
right.
They're scrambling to cover an inflated valuation. Plus, with these special kinds of mortgages where the rates go up, the principal payment starts to kick in, there's no reason to expect that people are going to be able to pay for their house anymore.
That's right. What's driving this thing globally is we had a bubble that emerged so rapidly and to such a huge degree that even Alan Greenspan would have to say this was his greatest work. This bubble grew to a size of $22 trillion in residential real estate valuations in the United States almost overnight. It grew by more than triple from 2001 to 2006, plus $6 trillion additional in mortgage-backed securities. And the household debt ratio to GDP, not only in the United States, but across the U.S., European, and developed Asian countries, grew from 25% of GDP to 91% of GDP by 2006. That gives you an idea of the bubble on which the entire world's banking systems came to base most of their operations. And what we're seeing now, as that bubble deflates, as soon as it starts to deflate, everybody becomes a loser. Everything goes down. As that bubble deflates, we're seeing that every banking operation in the world and every fund that these banks ran and every hedge fund that they had started and every leverage buyout and so forth was depending on this same bubble.
That's because they need the daily or weekly or monthly income stream that's paid on each of these mortgages.
Right. And that income stream was coming from nothing but the continued appreciation on paper of the value of these homes and condos and so forth in the U.S. bubble and the smaller bubbles in the United Kingdom and in Spain in particular and in Scandinavia. But it was
so Paul, in a sense then, banks were refinancing, doing second mortgages, so they were giving money to the holders of the first mortgage and increasing the debt of the person holding the mortgage.
That's right. And increasing that debt continuously against what was supposed to be the indefinite increase in the quote-unquote value, the market price of the home. And then, in effect, they were issuing mortgages in the form of various brands of securities and high yield and toxic waste securities, which were nothing but additional fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh mortgages, but these were going to hedge funds and their customers. They were going to leverage buyout firms in order to finance their buyouts of other companies. They were going to banks to finance commercial paper loans, so that everything was basing itself on this huge bubble. And there is no part of the financial system or the banking system in the world now which can escape the deflation and collapse of this bubble. That's what the European Central Bank has found out. And the European Central Bank head, Mr. Trichet, in his interview on Thursday afternoon, sounded like it had really driven him pretty crazy. He was describing the world economy as madness, but it was obvious that the madness had gotten through to him. He had become completely unhinged, and he was complaining that it took a 15% increase in the money supply every year to try to generate a 5% apparent growth in GDP, and that the world economy, as he said, had gone mad.
Well, as Lyndon LaRouche said, there's been a delusion for years that Greenspan was a genius. And yet, when just listening to you describe this, it's clear that he's the leading lunatic, Greenspan is, and that this delusion cannot continue. And we'll get back in a second to the underlying physical economy, what's happening with that. But I want to remind you, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. The LaRouche Show is live on the web every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. If you have a question for Paul, and I'm sure there are people out there with questions, give us a call, or you can rather send an email to radio@larouchepub.com. That's R-A-D-I-O, radio@larouchepub.com. And if you want some literature to discuss this, there's a lot of material coming out the last few weeks in the EIR and the our online publication, EIR Online. You can give us a call for that at 800-278-3135. Now, Paul, when you're describing this, you're describing the insanity of trying to sustain the financial bubble. But a financial bubble has to have some asset behind it. When you read about asset-backed commercial or asset-based commercial paper, there's supposedly an asset. What's happening to the actual assets behind this?
Well, there's been a crisis in what they call the asset-backed commercial paper market for the last 2 weeks, which actually was covered first on the LaRouche PAC website about a week and a half ago, and now it's much more broadly known and discussed, because banks, which again were generating excess liquidity for themselves and their hedge funds by using the appreciation of mortgages and using the mortgage-backed securities and using the derivatives on mortgage-backed securities to generate all this excess liquidity, they were putting a lot of it into buying short-term, buying, that is, lending for the short-term against assets, real or imaginary, of all kinds of corporations worldwide. And they were doing this, the banks were doing this, through what they call conduit funds, which were off their books because the loans they were making were very risky. But again, the liquidity for them was being generated out of this mortgage bubble. When the mortgage bubble melted down, the liquidity wasn't there all of a sudden at a certain point several weeks ago. It really started in the mid-July. The liquidity wasn't there to roll over all of this $2.5 to $3 trillion worth of asset-backed commercial paper. And so all of a sudden, demands for redemption, repayment of that, including early repayment, began to be made on every variety of company. They went to hedge funds for loans. They couldn't get it. They went to banks for loans. They couldn't get it. The funds that had extended the paper went to the banks and asked for bridge credits to keep it going. The banks turned them down. And so this paper, now here's where we hit the real economy again. This paper started going into default, and this is a major source in the United States and in Europe of investments of mutual funds into what they call money market index. Now, these are the most common kind of investments going in the world. Everybody.
These are 401ks. These are pension
exactly.
funds.
These are standard, so-called vanilla investments. They're supposed to be completely liquid. You know, you get your one share for every dollar that you have, and it grows.
So every listener who's hearing this is affected by this. If they have a job, if they've put money aside, if they are teachers who work for a city or a state, these are, I know that the city of Oakland, San Diego, they're putting city money in these pension funds, and pension funds are providing, I think you said earlier in the week, 40% of the money going to hedge funds now are from pension funds?
That's right, and they're plunging, they're continuing to plunge right up to today, these hedge funds. But, Harley, I'm making a distinction here. Those are recognized to be risque investments and have been for some time.
Mm-hmm.
The investments that mutual funds and money market funds make into this asset-backed commercial paper, these are considered to be the safest, most liquid little money makers that everybody should have their savings in, and virtually everybody does who owns any mutual funds or owns any money market. This is what people have put their savings in. Now, look what just happened in Canada when the commercial paper market went into a crisis in the middle of last week. They wound up taking 30- and 60-day loans, 30- and 60-day commercial paper, and by a bailout agreement, making a lot of it into 7- and 8-year loans. That means all of a sudden that what the savers thought was in a 30- to 60- to 90-day thing, which kept being turned into cash so that you could know it was there and you could reinvest it and so on, has suddenly been tied up in these mutual funds for 7 and 8 years against assets whose value nobody really knows at this point. So it's now in that sense, and this is a very big market, in that sense it's hitting people in their savings and it's hitting people directly in whether millions of us in America are going to get thrown out of our houses in the next period. And that is something that is really exercising many policy-making people that we're talking to. The one thing that is clearly recognized is that something has to be done now to stop the avalanche of defaults and foreclosures, which is getting bigger and bigger. And by the end of this, the months at the end of this year, you're going to be talking about 50 to 60,000 people a month losing their homes unless this is stopped.
Well, before we bring on the LIM panel, I want to take up the other side of this, which is that clearly from the standpoint of the speculators, there's a fight over who's going to get bailed out, who's going to be left holding the bag, is there a way to save the system at all? But the other side of it is that there are a lot of people, a lot of congressmen, who have introduced piecemeal bills, whether it's an infrastructure bill, whether it's some kind of a proposal to have either state or federal backup to stop some of the foreclosures. But there actually is a solution, which is the Economic Reconstruction Act, which has been updated and revised from 2006. People can see that by going to the LaRouche PAC website. But I have a twofold question for you, Paul. On the one hand, from what we see in the Congress, the people who are doing these piecemeal approaches, is there a sense, and we'll get from Michelle her view on this also, is there a sense that it's a systemic crisis? And why is it that you need an overall bill such as the LaRouche Economic Reconstruction Act to address the problem?
Well, we shouldn't forget that bridge that collapsed in St. Paul, Minneapolis. There is a sense that we have a severe infrastructure crisis. I think there's still tremendous denial that Congress has to act in the mode of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration, the bank holiday of 1933, the urgency of taking that kind of broad emergency measure to right the banking system, to keep people in their homes and to save jobs and produce jobs, there is still a denial that they have that kind of responsibility on their shoulders, which they absolutely do.
Although I would add, Paul, that as we were talking before the show, in both Massachusetts and California, there were debates in the Democratic Party at the state conventions and in Los Angeles Central Committee meetings as to how to deal with the housing crisis. And in both cases, there were resolutions drafted by members of the LaRouche Youth Movement calling for this FDR solution that were debated, some people saying, no, we don't need a wholesale bankruptcy reorganization. And yet the resolutions did pass in those two key states, Massachusetts and California.
Yes, that Massachusetts resolution is dynamite because it was thoroughly debated by many hundreds of people at the state Democratic convention and then passed 2-1 in the whole convention. The elected officials of the entire state, at least all those who are Democrats, which are the majority, they were all there. They saw and heard that debate, and that the citizens brought up the question, is the mortgage meltdown that bad that we have to reorganize the banks in order to solve it? We have to declare the banks to be holding worthless paper and bankrupt them in order to solve it. And they decided that the LaRouche Youth Movement had shown their case that this was that bad. They voted for it, and it's a marker for the whole elected officials all over the country who now can see that those who introduced that resolution were absolutely right, that the Democrats of Massachusetts were absolutely right to pass it, and it's a guideline. We have to have foreclosure moratorium or a foreclosure holiday, as one policymaker suggested to us yesterday, a national foreclosure holiday, like a bank holiday and perhaps a mortgage holiday in general. But we also have to take this worthless paper that's in every bank, we can see it now, and declare it to be worthless and therefore reorganize those banks to issue productive credit only.
Well, and that was also passed in Los Angeles County. Let me bring in Michelle Lerner on this, because Michelle is one of the people responsible for the deployment on Capitol Hill. And while the House and Senate are in recess right now, in recent weeks we've been escalating the mobilization of the LaRouche Youth Movement with the lessons of the failure of the Congress, both the last Congress and this Congress so far, to act on what were the policy initiatives by Lyndon LaRouche. Michelle, how do things look from your view on in the Congress? Are people beginning to get the point that this is a systemic crisis?
Well, you brought up the fact that they're on recess right now, and I would say that literally as well as figuratively, a lot of these guys are still on vacation. Since the period of time that Mr. LaRouche in particular issued his statement saying that the system has already collapsed, that was in a period right before they went out of session. They were involved in a lot of busy work. We were going in there really trying to reach everybody with this statement saying that the system has already collapsed, you can't go out of session, and also for the fact that because of the severity of the collapse, you also have a situation, as we've seen in the recent days, where Dick Cheney would take the opportunity to escalate in a war drive against Iran. So we were very clear on our message in those last few weeks, right before they went out of session, and these guys pretty much rushed to get out of there and to go back to their districts, I guess, to get beaten up by their constituents, but nevertheless, they rushed to get out of there. Since then, we've been, over the past week, we've been going into the offices of the Financial Services Committee in particular, as well as the Infrastructure and Transportation Committee. And what we've been finding is that a lot of the people that are there, for the most part, are really blind to what's going on. They don't have, they may have heard something is sour with subprime mortgages, but they don't have a full, a picture of the full scope of the problem. They don't really have a sense yet of how dire the situation is. So the fact that we just got in this latest issue of EIR, a report that goes through the state of the infrastructure in the United States, how poor the infrastructure actually is, what these bills are that are being introduced, these Roatan bills, how that is not a solution at all. And the alternative that is our reconstruction, our Emergency Reconstruction Act of 2007, all of that in this latest package, in this latest EIR, we got that into the Congress today, this week. That's extremely important because it has to be demonstrated to the members of Congress and their staff the severity of the crisis. Despite the fact that we're seeing our bridges collapse, they still haven't, because of an ideological problem, they still have not been able to link the fact that this is caused by the way that we've been thinking about economics in this country over the past several decades. So it puts a lot of work on us here in D.C. I'm sure as they're in their districts, when they're having more and more of these town hall meetings, these issues are going to come up and help shed some light on the matter for them. But as it stands right now, there's still a lot of work we have to do.
Well, this is what Lyndon LaRouche has described as the deeper level of the tragedy when he, in his new Democratic Party platform, the prolegomena for a platform, to me it seems really striking. And Paul, I'd like you to comment on this, that in the same week you had two Bear Stearns funds that supposedly had $9 billion in them just go poof, and all of a sudden there's nothing. And in a puff of smoke, a bridge collapsed. I mean, it may be stretching the metaphor a little bit, but actually we're seeing a lot of what people think have assets with value turning into nothing. And yet, other than the obligatory cries, we have to do something, is it the lack of will, or, as Michelle says, is it the ideological blindness of the last three-plus decades of idiocy on economics?
Well, I think that what Michelle said is right on the mark. As Lynn always talks about, the axioms by which people are operating make them behave in a tragic way in a situation like this until they're snapped out of it by a combination of events and our own intervention, making clear what can be done, what has to be done, what's been done in the past, the FDR model on this. Their axioms are governing them, and they don't believe under those axioms that there is any way that they're authorized to do anything potent in this situation, even of the infrastructure collapse. At the same time, they look on a day-to-day basis, they see the Federal Reserve. I've lost track now, but certainly it has issued $100 billion worth in a matter of a week or so, $100 billion worth of new credit into the banking system. It has, in the process, purchased a lot of U.S. Treasury bills. It is incurring new debt of the United States government, of the United States Treasury, printing new debt, in effect, in order to do that. So whence came this $100 billion authorization in a matter of less than 2 weeks to throw that amount of money into completely wasted bailouts. Now, I'll give you an example. Countrywide, $11.5 billion in credit lines from 40 banks, when those banks that same day were receiving $17 billion worth of injections from the Federal Reserve, liquidity injections from the Federal Reserve. That is where that liquidity is going. It's going to save bankrupts. Countrywide is the biggest lender in the country, but if you let it go bankrupt, which it is, its mortgage holders would not lose their homes as a result of that bankruptcy, per se. Rather, the continuous attempt by Countrywide to sell those loans, those mortgages as securities, and cover itself and generate liquidity for new mortgages and so forth, that would all be interrupted by a bankruptcy. That would be far healthier for the economy than to pour that money into Countrywide when at the same time they're saying they're going to practically shut down their lending anyway. So they're not, that money is not going into new mortgages. That money is going into an attempt to keep up the value of the mortgage-backed securities and derivatives that they've already issued they've already had people buy. So this $100 billion or more in such a short period of time is an earnest of exactly that's the way governments create credit, but they need to create it for the purpose of rebuilding the infrastructure.
Well, this is another one of these ironies where you have, I saw an article yesterday by Alan Sloan, who's the senior editor-at-large of Fortune magazine, who expresses his deep shock, and of course he's not really shocked, but he said that the Wall Street bankers say that when a hedge fund gets in trouble or a small fry gets in trouble, let them take the loss. But when it's the banks, they say, no, it's bailout city. And so the same people who say you can't create credit for infrastructure, for water and power systems, for levees and dams, when a bank is in trouble, they can create unlimited amount of credit to pour into a bottomless pit.
So that's the axioms that we're talking about. What has to be changed is the elected official who sees a bridge collapse and kill 10 or 12 people. Miraculously, it wasn't more, but, you know, an entire bridge collapse, and says, we can't do that. We can't issue credit to stop that from happening any further. But then sees a bank collapse and goes into a panic and says, we have to issue credit immediately in order to prevent this from happening any further. And it's the same process, but it's being thrown into waste. They're also demanding, some of them, Dodd and Frank and other members of the Senate and House, that Fannie Mae be allowed to purchase much larger numbers of mortgages and mortgage-backed securities and purchase the mortgages on much more expensive homes. And clearly that will bail out exactly the Countrywides and other mortgage lenders, which have driven themselves into bankruptcy in this way. It's the use of the government's sovereign power of creating credit for precisely the wrong purposes.
Well, let me bring in one of our axiom busters from the great northwest of this country. We have Jacob Johnson on the line. And in Seattle, you know, oftentimes people in Seattle act as though they're not part of the same United States. But Jacob, I know you guys have been having a lot of fun and some success in taking on these axioms. How's it been going up there?
Well, it's been a lot of fun. We had this, you know, international deployment basically into the financial sector across the world this week. And one of the things we did, just to bring a little fun in here, because it seems to be that it takes about a decade. I put a decade as a good amount for reality to hit. So people are just starting to realize that the mullet is no longer an acceptable hairstyle.
You think with all that coffee they drink up there, people would be more awake, huh?
No kidding. So we went out, you know, we went to the financial sector, and the financial sector knows it's going down, but they don't want to admit it. So we brought a friend out with, you know, a slightly ill-fitting suit, and he he had a cardboard sign on him. Said, "My hedge fund has collapsed. I've lost everything. Can you spare some liquidity?" Anything will help. And it's quite fun, because one of the things that I had a question, really, because
sure.
I've gotten this line several times, where you get this two sides of the argument that with the subprime mortgages, it's either the people, these people shouldn't have taken out these mortgages. They really, couldn't afford it, and they knew it. And, I mean, they had to have known that eventually their rate was going to go up. Or it's the lenders. This is the Democratic line that we get, is that these lenders, these evil, corrupt lenders, are giving out these mortgages, and they have been horrible, and we've got to regulate them. But the way a lot of people have been looking at it up here is just, it's not so much that it's these subprime mortgages in and of themselves, the lenders are the people, but it's what caused this entire situation. I don't know if one of you guys wanted to address that, maybe.
Yeah, Paul, why don't you take that up?
Well, you do hear that all the time. It's the mortgage brokers, they were
the predatory lenders.
Predatory lenders and so on and so forth. And it's funny now, all the hedge funds, as they send out their announcements of their huge losses, they all blame other hedge funds. Or else they blame irrational investors. They blame anybody except themselves for having lost 30 or 40%. When they had appreciated 30%, it was all because of their brilliant trading strategy. But now that they're losing, it's because of something some other cowardly hedge fund did. This is common in this situation, but we know who created the bubble. It wasn't mortgage lenders, who in almost every case are creatures of banks. It used to be that if you got a mortgage 20 years ago or so, you got a mortgage from a bank. Almost nobody does that now, because the banks all spun off mortgage lenders, and the mortgage lending companies which they had spun off then spun off thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of brokers. So now you get your mortgage from a broker who gets it from a mortgage lender, which is a creature of a bank. And that's just the beginning of the security chain. And it was that security, the decision of the Wall Street to produce these securities and securitize every mortgage, that made the mortgage lenders, and particularly the brokers, particularly completely irresponsible. I mean, what did they have to care about whether this loan could ever be paid off by the person who was borrowing it or not? If they could convince the person to take it, didn't matter if they could pay it off, because it would have been sold several times and securitized by the time the second payment was being made 2 months down the road. So this securitization is what did it. But who pushed securitization? Sir Alan Greenspan of the Federal Reserve. In speech after speech, in regulation after regulation, I won't bore people by going through the changes in the regulations that made this possible, but all through 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, Greenspan pushed this, that the subprime mortgage sector is crucial because it's allowing people to become homeowners. And the mortgage-backed securities are crucial because they're allowing liquidity from all over the world to flow into this.
And Paul, isn't this also the whole question of the deregulation of the markets? This is what the Rowetton policy is, that the private markets are the ones that have the money, and you don't need government credit.
That's right. And they were also trying to get rid of or shrink down to almost nothing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I saw that happening in Washington intensively over the same period of years, that all of the neocons wanted to eliminate those FDR-era government lending guarantee corporations. And they said the banks can do this, the private banks can do this, everything that Fannie and Freddie do just as well or better, and it'll be more efficient and less expensive and so on and so forth. Now they're desperately turning back and saying, pump us more money through Fannie and Freddie, if you please, right away. This is entirely a creation of the banks, pushed to do so by Alan Greenspan's policies at the Federal Reserve, mm-hmm. including his continual defense of the very derivatives
collateralized debt obligations and so forth, which are now toxic everywhere in the hedge funds and in the banking system. So that was the change that took place that resulted, as I was indicating before, in where household debt as a proportion of GDP all over the 26 countries of the OECD, that used to be 25% of GDP for all those countries. Now it's in excess of 90%. And the corporate debt bubble, which only 15 years ago was equal to about 55% of GDP for all those 26 countries, is now nearly 90% of GDP. That's the debt piled on by the leveraged buyouts and so forth. Those bubbles are what were created through the banking system. No one can claim that they were created by any greedy American homeowner. They were created through the banking system and the central banks led by the Federal Reserve, and that is now collapsing.
I think it'd be very useful for anyone who's listening to this and wants to get this full picture. Call in immediately and get your subscription to the EIR online. You can do that through calling a toll-free number. It's 800-278-3135. And you can also get the up-to-the-minute short slugged reports from going to the LaRouchePack.com, where we have a greatly upgraded website now that can put you right in the middle of this. I know we've had a tripling of the visits to the website recently. Now, Michelle, I know you take pedagogy very seriously, the ability to try and teach these concepts to people. Do you think some of these staffers are educable? I mean, is reality hitting enough that they're beginning to look at these axioms?
Well, as I said earlier, I think right now we're in a situation where we do have a lot of work to do. However, they're human. And as has always been the basis of LaRouche's economic outlook, is that the human mind has an incredible potential to make discoveries and breakthroughs, especially in great times of crisis. So, yeah, of course. And besides, without that, I mean, that's really our only option, is to fight to get these guys to make these breakthroughs. But I actually had a question on the on Alan Greenspan and this whole policy of making bubbles, because LaRouche has also made the point that this system really collapsed in 1987, which is the point that Greenspan had stepped in and with this type of shift in policy. And anywhere you look to try to find out what happened in 1987, it's always a mystery. So I was actually wondering if you could say anything on that in particular.
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, the 87 stock market crash in October of 87 was just one step in what was then a real estate bubble collapsing. At that time, it was a commercial real estate bubble, primarily, that was falling apart and led to the disappearance of all of the savings and loans in the United States, as people know, in that crisis. But what Greenspan did, and LaRouche has frequently pointed to this, what he did was come in immediately on the heels or in the later stages of that crisis. He was appointed in 87, and he began immediately to build other bubbles of debt based on residential real estate, on the looting of the former Soviet Union areas and former Soviet areas of Europe, and then increasingly based on the dot-com telecommunications interrelated bubbles, which became huge in the 1990s. When those in turn fell apart, or the signs were that they were falling apart, then he went to work on the current residential mortgage-based bubbles in the United States and the UK in particular, which dwarf all the previous ones put together. I was giving an idea of the magnitude of them at the beginning of the discussion. And he made sure that the capital of the entire world flowed into them. Again, by these rule changes, by the continual promotion of the subprime mortgages, of the derivatives based on them, of the mortgage-backed securities, he got the capital of the entire world, which was coming out of the globalized, cheaper and cheaper labor system, which was generating false but nonetheless clinking profits among firms all over the world as a result of this cheap labor driving globalization. He got them flowing into this bubble of U.S. mortgages and essentially indebted the American population, American households, to replace the real income which they were losing, and then some, by debt upon debt upon debt, all usually based on their house or their houses or their condos, to the point where this bubble simply dwarfed anything ever seen before, and every form of financial instrument in the world was being invested into this. So when it went, it went. And it is literally Alan Greenspan's collapse, which is in which we're now. His postponed and worsened and postponed and worsened 1987 collapse, which we're now living through.
I think one of the other moments of this was in 1992, right after the election of Bill Clinton. There's a report that Greenspan went to have a dinner with him in Little Rock, Arkansas. And Clinton had run in his 92 campaign on a platform of investing in infrastructure, something in the range of $80 billion, and then he narrowed it down to $40 billion, and he presented this to Greenspan. And Greenspan,
the Build America plan, yeah.
Yeah, and Greenspan's response was, if you want to be a popular president and you want to help the economy, you have to be more concerned about the markets. And to do that, you can't invest money into infrastructure. You have to have a flow of money into the markets. And, of course, this was also, you had Greenspan on the one side and then Al Gore on the other side pushing this. And they convinced Clinton that free trade and globalization would be the way to build up the economy. And, of course, that was the beginning of the second phase of the post-1987 bubble.
Yeah, that's very important, Harley, because that's the last time that any American president, that's the only time since the early 80s, that any American president talked about any significant investment in our infrastructure. It's literally been that long. People say it's dropped from 4% to 2% of GDP, the total investment in infrastructure. Historically, it's been 4 to 5%. Now it's less than 2. Well, this is how it happened. When Clinton tried to move with that thing, Greenspan said no. The Republican Party in Congress, which had a majority then, was organized to a solid front, 100% vote against any infrastructure plan from Clinton. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Washington Post, and so forth wrote editorial after editorial lampooning this thing, saying this is a complete waste of money, and it was killed. And Clinton never tried again to talk about major infrastructure investments. And that was literally the only time in the last 25 years that the country has come close to doing anything but, you know, the usual token highway bill.
And that's the backdrop to what happened in New Orleans with Katrina and the bridge on the other end of the Mississippi River up in Minneapolis, that non-investment. Jacob, you have any other questions for Paul or anything else you'd like to add?
Just a couple quick things. One was to just emphasize that up in Seattle, one of the successes we've had is getting youth in to actually work on a lot of this this drive to master LaRouche's economics. We just finished up a 10-week-long series of going through LaRouche's So You Wish to Learn About Economics. And that just, you know, we've been having young people here virtually every hour of the day, almost every day, you know, going to pick one person up and you drop another person off and pick someone else up. And it's been a ton of fun because there's new faces all over the place. But the other question I did have that was related to this was the other bookend. The Yang-Kerry trade is still a very hazy thing to me. what exactly has happened there. Okay. I heard the yen is going up in value, but that doesn't seem to mean much. So if you could touch on that, Paul.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that still has a long way to go before it completely disintegrates. But it definitely, here's how it works. The yen has been maintaining, the Bank of Japan ever since the late 1980s, with very few brief exceptions during that period of time, has been maintaining a policy of loaning money at virtually zero interest rates. There, where we think of our interest rates as being 5.25% or whatever, theirs has been basically zero. And it's been that way for more than 15 years as a result of agreements in the 1980s that were forced on Japan by George Shultz and collaborators of George Shultz. Cheney himself was involved in that. That has meant that anybody in the world could go borrow yen at virtually 0%, take them anywhere else in the world, and invest them in currencies. And that's the easy way. You know, invest in the Icelandic krona or the Australian dollar or whatever it is, the British pound, or the U.S. dollar, and make a lot of money that way, or invest in treasury securities of those same countries, make a lot of money automatically that way. And that trade is usually estimated at something like $500 billion. That is, hedge funds alone have about $250 billion worth of loans borrowed in yen, which they're investing in various speculations all over the world. And another $250 billion or more is accounted for by Japanese and other investors who are not hedge funds. Now, they're making money two ways, or they were. One is that the interest rate is differential makes it so easy. And the other is that this tends to drive the yen lower and lower. So they're also making money on how cheap it is to get the yen loan in the first place, relative to the currency that you're going to use for your investment. When the yen suddenly goes up, it indicates that the carry trade is being unwound, as they say, because you're losing more on the sudden appreciation of the yen than you're making on the difference in interest rates between the two. So all of a sudden this turns into a losing investment. Now think of $250 billion worth of hedge funds around the world, hedge fund investments around the world suddenly becoming losers, and you get an idea of the other bookend. It's much smaller than the mortgage collapse, but it's been a real driver for speculative investments worldwide, especially this carry trade. There's also a Swiss franc carry trade, but this is the big one, and the one that's been going on forever. Now that the yen has really risen very high, they'll probably start a new carry trade based on the interest rate differential, which will go on for a short period of time as the collapse. In other words, people will go back, and hedge funds and so forth will go back and try that game again and get slammed even worse the second time. So it still has a ways to go.
But they're still looking for suckers, and that brings us back to the question of tragedy. Michelle, let me just ask you, because we have about 6.5 minutes to go, and I know that you're already starting to think about the Congress returning. Hopefully they're going to get a dose of reality in their districts. But what's on tap when the Congress returns? We've got the Reconstruction Act. Are we situated in such a way that we think we can get some breakthroughs on this? How are we going to be doing this when they get back?
Well, we've been pretty much preparing ourselves as well. I have to say that given considering that this is the type of economic system that most of our youth members have been raised in, as we're supposedly a no-future generation, it puts us in an interesting situation because you really have to take the time to think through what is different about the type of approach that Mr. LaRouche is taking, which is actually historically the American system approach. So that means that we really have to use our imaginations to break free of the type of thinking that we're educated in, the way that economics is generally taught at universities and in schools, and really think through what were the principles that established the American system of political economy. So luckily, there's records of these things, like Hamilton's reports on to the Congress on the subject of manufacturers, national banking, public credit. There's other things that can be worked through as well. Lincoln's policies, probably the most important because of what is in the recent memory of the population, is the policies of Franklin Roosevelt and his collaborators like Harry Hopkins and others. So there's a lot that we have to work through ourselves to really get a reference point for how these types of projects can be carried out. But also, as I mentioned earlier, Paul was involved in this, we have this new Emergency Reconstruction Act, which is an advancement over the Emergency Reconstruction Act of 2006 that we had put out last year, where there's a much more discussion of how you take on this question of national banking. So, again, that's something that we've been discussing to try to figure out exactly what is the best approach to take to communicate the ideas that have to be communicated to those who are really in charge of policy making. So I know that's the best thing that we can be doing right now, is really getting a sense of educating ourselves so we can convey these ideas to those who are going to be making the policies when they do return.
Harley, I should just add that a lot of economists and everybody realizes, who's at all serious, that millions of people in this country are facing losing their homes. A lot of economists have been talking to us about another aspect of this, which is that as the Boston resolution that we did ourselves, that the LIM did months ago, mm-hmm. in the Democratic Party, that the foreclosures have to be stopped, that there has to be a national holiday on foreclosures and maybe on mortgage payments as such, while those mortgages are replaced by a new housing agency, like a new federal housing agency. The FHA was created in the 30s by Roosevelt to deal with exactly this situation. Most people, almost everybody in the United States is now, who has a mortgage at all, is now living in a home which is starting to get worse, less to be worth less than the mortgage. And that's a crisis for everyone. And certainly everyone who hasn't already largely paid off their home, the value of the home is sinking below the mortgage. And that, if that isn't dealt with by a kind of mortgage holiday combined with the issuance of new fixed rate mortgages for long term at a lower, more realistic price of the home, then there's going to be mass loss of homes to foreclosure. That's another element of this, which is broadly realized and which Congress is going to have to act on.
Well, I had the opportunity yesterday to speak before a group of older Democrats out in the West Coast, and one of them was just perplexed and finally said to me, "What does Mr. LaRouche mean in his webcast when he says the post-FDR era is over? Does that mean FDR is done?" And I said, no, the post-FDR era, after FDR's death, there was a change in policy, and that string has been played out. Now we have to go back to FDR. And he said, well, why didn't he just say it? The time for FDR is now. And I said, well, you know, this is an irony. This caused you to think about it, didn't it? And he got a grin on his face, and he said, I think LaRouche thinks that we can think better than we can. And this gets back to something Michelle said. I said, you're a human being. You can figure these things out. And I think that's what we have going for us, that as Lynn wrote in the epilogue to his new paper, there's embedded in the American people these constitutional principles, such as justice, such as the idea of a better future, live for your posterity, And that's what we have to call up in people. So, Paul, thank you for joining us today. Michelle and Jacob, thank you very much. This has been the LaRouche Show. Join us again next Saturday for the LaRouche Show.